Jim Bell on our entry into the interstellar age, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. Today, a conversation with famed planetary scientist Jim Bell about his wonderful new book that tells the story of the Voyager mission. Bill Nye, the science guy, will help us remember Leonard Nimoy. While later we'll visit with Bruce Betts and get some cosmic potty humor, we begin with Emily Lakdawalla. The Planetary Society senior editor posted a blog entry on February 26th about the Dawn mission's imminent arrival at dwarf planet Ceres. Now there's even more news to share. Emily, as we speak, a press briefing has just finished on NASA TV coming out of JPL about the Ceres mission. You also just wrote about this mission. Didn't sound like there was a whole lot of new news, but what did you hear?
Well, I heard that the team is understandably extremely excited about the new images and particularly excited about features on the surface of Ceres that they did not expect to see and are looking forward to investigating after they go into orbit next week.
You must be first, at least, talking about those mysterious white spots.
Yeah, you know, we did expect to see something bright on the surface because Hubble saw a bright spot on the surface of Ceres. But I have to say that they probably did not expect what they saw, which is a spot that remains so bright and yet so small that they can't resolve it in their current images. They're going to have to get closer in order to get enough pixels across to try to figure out what the heck these things are.
All right, now I have a very brief comment about these from Deputy Project Scientist Carol Raymond, who was at the briefing.
The team is really, really excited about this feature because it is unique in the solar system. We will be revealing its true nature as we get closer and closer to the surface. So the mystery will be solved, but it is one that's really got us on the edge of our seats.
Another thing that was a major topic of the press briefing you also wrote about in your great blog entry, and that's this crater with a remarkably flat floor?
Yeah, it is so flat. You know, when a crater forms, it's a hole. It digs a deep hole into the surface of a world. Now, if you have an icy world like Ceres we know has to be composed at least partially of ice because its density is considerably less than that of rock. You expect that over time the craters will flatten, but this is a very large crater that is very, very flat, and it doesn't contain very many craters inside it, so that tells you it's also geologically relatively recent. This is a place where a lot of geology has happened. It's too early to tell that geologic story, but I can tell you it's a place on Ceres that the science team is going to be investigating very closely once they get a little bit closer to the surface.
And here is Carol Raymond once again on this topic.
This may indicate a region of distinct geologic processes. And as Don goes through his comprehensive mapping, we'll obtain the data that we need to understand what this complex structure is telling us about the subsurface.
But it's going to be a little while before we can see it much closer because Dawn actually overshoots Ceres a little bit as it goes into orbit and is now on the night side of Ceres. And, you know, Dawn can do a lot of things, but it can't see in the dark. So we're not seeing the surface of Ceres right now, and we won't again for a little bit. It's going to be a while before we get newer pictures that show higher resolution toward the end of April. But it's going to be really exciting once it starts to happen.
This next chapter in the story of Ceres is going to be an exciting one. Thank you very much, Emily.
Thank you, Matt.
Emily Lakdawalla is our senior editor at the Planetary Society, our planetary evangelist, also a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Up next, Bill Nye with a tribute. First, though, a bit more of Carol Raymond.
It's clear that discoveries lie ahead, as Ceres will be revealed in stunning detail, just like Vesta.
Bill, we mark the passing of a guy who wasn't a scientist. He was just an actor, but he sure inspired a lot of us.
Just an actor. No, Leonard Nimoy died, everybody, and he played Spock. And even if you have never seen Star Trek, you hate Star Trek, you hate science fiction, you hate everything, the guy changed the world. His interpretation of this character really changed the way many people perceive, I think, ourselves. In his context, that is to say, in Spock's world, was a scientific and optimistic view of the future, that
yes,
through science and technology, things one day would be better. In fact, all the traditional problems that you and I have of food, shelter, clothing, these are all solved in Star Trek's future. Instead of being apocalyptic, as so many science fiction stories are, Star Trek was optimistic. And that optimism, that optimistic view of the future came from their understanding of the cosmos. They flew around the cosmos effortlessly. Boom. And then everywhere they went, the stories were about, well, were about people. Were about how humans or how sentient beings get along. It's something that I think affected all of us.
So here's a plug for the blog post that I put up over the weekend. It's my tribute as a science fan to Leonard Nimoy. I think people who believed that, you know, emotionless logic was uppermost in Spock's mind, no, they didn't get it. Spock wanted to know. He was a scientist. He wanted knowledge.
He was curious.
Yeah,
plus,
exactly.
You know, he was half human. And then his, you may recall, his father, rather Spock, asked his father about his mother. She's illogical, isn't she? His father said, she's always been so. Indeed. Why did you marry? And he said, at the time, it seemed the logical thing to do. Oh, it changed the world. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you, Bill.
We will all miss him. We will all miss him. And it just shows you it's part of a collaboration. Gene Roddenberry had this great vision of the future, and the actors brought this remarkable storytelling to it. It's really something. Thanks, Matt.
Live long and prosper, Bill.
Good advice, sir. Thank you.
He's Bill Nye, the CEO of the Planetary Society, a trekker, a Trekkie, like yours truly. And he joins us most weeks here on the radio show. Coming up next, we're going to talk to his buddy, actually, Jim Bell. I've often called scientist and author Jim Bell the Ansel Adams of Mars. It's a compliment he earned through his magnificent work creating and sharing images of the red planet, especially those taken by Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity. The results included his best-selling books, Postcards from Mars and Mars 3D. Jim has taken on a new literary challenge with his latest work. The Interstellar Age Inside the 40-Year Voyager Mission has just been published. It's a sweeping yet personal biography of the historic grand tour of our solar system by twin spacecraft that are now venturing outward toward the stars. Dr. Bell is a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University. He's gearing up to continue his exploration of Mars with the main cameras on the coming 2020 rover. Jim also serves as president of the Planetary Society, and it was at Planetary Society headquarters a few days ago that we sat down to talk about the book. Jim Bell, welcome back to Planetary Radio.
Great to be here, Matt. I love Planetary Radio.
I'm going to guess that a lot of people, myself included, think of you as almost exclusively a Martian. But what I learned from this terrific book is that you cut your teeth in the outer solar system on the Voyager mission.
It's true. That's where I got my start. It's kind of my motivation for writing the book. Voyager has had just a huge influence on my life, on my career, as it has for so many other people. I do think of myself as having sort of some outer solar system roots.
This is partly a personal story because you were involved with the mission. It's far more than that, as I'm sure we'll get into as we go on. But I want to start with that personal side. Mm-hmm. Take us back to the fall of 1985, and you're a student at Caltech. Your mentor, Ed Danielson, drops by at the end of the day with an invitation for you.
Yeah, so Ed was a member of the Voyager imaging team. Super amazing guy, jolly fellow, always with a smile on his face, always with a helpful piece of advice or tip or something. And I was working for him as an undergraduate doing some crazy kind of work called image processing. Nobody knew what that was at the time. And there was a single computer that was used in this group. It was grunt work. It was perfect for a student. He had me working on displaying images of Saturn from the 1980 flyby of Voyager, and these are 800 by 800 pixel images, and the display would take 30 seconds to sort of like scroll the picture down. It was like watching paint drip down a wall, you know, 30 seconds just to display a picture on this workstation, and that was cutting edge. And then I had to click and find the edge of the planet and fit a limb profile. And that was great work, but it was grunt work, and he needed somebody to do grunt work, and the computer was available in the wee hours of the morning, perfect for a student. And I'd overlap with Ed in the mornings, usually, when he would come in. And he knew I was doing this work, and he knew that I just loved looking at the pictures of Saturn and other pictures that were kind of lying around in his office and coming off the printer. And I knew that he and others were getting excited about the Uranus encounter coming up. We occasionally could see pictures on that workstation or elsewhere at Caltech of this bluish blob getting slightly bigger every day. And it was still just a dot, a point of light. And then that fall is when he said, hey, you know, by the way, I'm allowed to, you know, get a couple of extra people into the encounter. And, you know, would you like to come? And I was just like speechless. Oh, yeah, sure. Sure, Ed, that'd be great, you know. And because I, you know, I try to explain to people, my kids, my students, you know, what the world was like without internet, right? Without the ability to experience these things in near real time like we do now. You know, we get Mars rover pictures out there in real time. Cassini does the same thing. We all watch comet landings in real time. And we're just so used to experiencing that now. But back in the day, right, back in the mid-80s, there was no internet. And so the only way to experience this was to be there, to be in the room if you wanted to experience it. And I had no specific job. I wasn't on the imaging team. I wasn't in the field yet. I was a lowly undergraduate. And yet the opportunity to be in that room was like gold. And so I jumped at it.
There are so many wonderful real life characters, people really that I think of as heroes in this story. Mm-hmm. We've already mentioned Ed Danielson. We can't go through all of them. There's just no time. Right. But I want to ask you about three of them who come up over and over mm-hmm. as you tell the story of this decades-long continuing mission,
yeah.
beginning with Charlie Colhase.
Charlie Colhase, who's also a great friend of the Planetary Society, is just an amazing character, absolutely, an amazing person, and just an incredibly skilled engineer. I have just the greatest respect for Charlie and the team of about a dozen people that he led trying to figure out how to thread this incredible needle of sending both spacecraft to exactly the right place at exactly the right time. He and they had an impossible job, right? They had to, without supercomputers, without even laptops, pen and paper sometimes, they had to figure out how to manipulate the trajectory of the spacecraft, both of them, so that they not only passed really close to each planet, because we want high-resolution pictures, but passed as closely as possible to all the moons that were out there, which are in their own racetrack orbits around the planets, and hit perfectly the spot needed to slingshot them onto the next planet. He told me these stories, some of which I recount in the book, about, you know, 10,000 possible trajectories and these folks kind of laboring over, you know, well, we've got these constraints and we don't want to pass by the planet on the night side because the darn scientists want to take pictures of the clouds and the sunlight, throw those possible orbits away. And they went through, you know, it took them years to go through and find the two solutions that they eventually flew those spacecraft on. And I'm convinced, and so is he, that they did the best possible job they could. And it was a lot of hard work and it really paid off.
Two needles in a haystack.
Exactly.
Planetary scientist Jim Bell. He'll be back in a minute to tell us more about his new book, The Interstellar Age. This is Planetary Radio.
Greetings, Planetary Radio listeners. Bill Nye, the science guy here. The Planetary Society's remarkable LightSail spacecraft is headed for space. We want you to come along. LightSail is a small spacecraft propelled by photons from the sun. The excitement is building as we count down to our launch in May. Follow every aspect of the mission at sail.planetary.org. Let's change the world.
Random Space Fact. Nothing new about that for you, Planetary Radio fans, right? Wrong. Random Space Fact is now a video series, too. And it's brilliant, isn't it, Matt?
I hate to say it, folks, but it really is, and hilarious.
See, Matt would never lie to you, would he?
I really wouldn't.
A new Random Space Fact video is released each Friday at youtube.com/planetarysociety. You can subscribe to join our growing community, and you'll never miss a fact.
Can I go back to my radio now? Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. Jim Bell's latest book is The Interstellar Age, Inside the 40-Year Voyager Mission.
Our complete half-hour conversation can be heard in the online version of today's show at planetary.org/radio. The book covers every component of the incredibly complex mission, along with all of its science and magnificent discoveries. Arguably, the most important element of Voyager's success has been the people behind it. I asked Jim to tell me about two more key players.
Candy Hansen, who started out on Voyager as a someone called a kind of a sequencer and a representative liaison between the scientists and the engineers. Of course, she's gone on to be a leading scientist on Cassini and other missions, Mars missions since then. Her role was to speak both languages, the science language and the jargon. We want these kinds of photometric observations with these exposure times, you know, and we're trying to get after these particular geologic processes or whatever. And she understood that language, but she had to translate that into the language that the engineers were speaking, which is the commands, the detailed commands for the imaging system and other instruments, the ones and zeros that the Deep Space Network speaks in. And she did that really well. And she was the person that also the science team would kind of throw under the bus at the last minute and say, hey, you know, go tell the engineers we need to change the sequence. And there's only 2 hours to go, you know. And she'd be like sheepishly, oh, you know, we need to make a tweak. And instead of getting them all upset, she would bake them cookies or make some other wonderful remarks or bribes. Cookies were the big one. And she, you know, endeared herself to that group as well. And it just she's a great example of how it's the communication and close interaction between scientists and engineers that make these things happen.
Okay, finally, the incomparable Ed Stone.
Ed Stone is, you know, Ed Stone is has been the project scientist for Voyager since, I think, 1974 or 5, somewhere around there, before launch. The project has had 10 project managers, but one project scientist, Ed Stone. And I think of Ed as the king of Voyager. He's a benevolent dictator who rules wisely from his perch up on high in the exosphere, watching the solar wind interact with the magnetic fields. And his science is what I call the squiggly line science, the cosmic rays and space weather kind of stuff. And
stuff that shows up on graphs,
and
not
graphs
in
and charts, exactly, not in photographs. And yet, he's just as excited as anybody else about the amazing pictures and other kinds of measurements that aren't his personal science in the mission. And his job was even harder than herding cats. And the cats in this case were the science teams, the dozens and dozens of scientists for the 12 experiments or so on the spacecraft, who were all vying for this precious resource called time. Remember, Voyagers were flybys. They're not orbiters where you can loop around and have multiple chances to look at things, or rovers where you can stop and turn around and go back and redo things. These were flybys, first-time flybys in some cases, one time only. Maybe you'd have the second spacecraft coming behind you for Jupiter and Saturn, but that wasn't the case for Uranus and Neptune. You got one shot. You're traveling at 10 miles a second, and you get one shot. Everybody wants to make their measurements at the best possible time, and so there's all this competition. And Ed's job was to adjudicate that, to choose. He confesses, you know, in the book, he's done it before, that, you know, it's a really hard thing to say, well, you get to do your science now, and then you have to wait, and then they get to do their science. But somebody had to do that. And he managed to pull it off without upsetting people in a really fair and equitable way. And the result is, you know, spectacular scientific data sets from all the instruments from the spacecraft. And he's also just level-headed. He's very, very scientifically careful and conservative. When Ed says this is the result, like Voyager 1 has left the solar system, people believe it. And that's an important, critical characteristic of a project scientist, a scientific leader in a project like this.
And that was an announcement he was very careful about. You talk about the process of deciding, has this spacecraft actually left the neighborhood?
Yeah. So, you know, the sun and all stars around us have these bubbles around them, these heliospheres, they're called, the magnetic fields and cosmic ray, solar wind and all that sort of keep the cosmic rays from outside the bubble from coming in for the most part. The instruments that Voyager 1 has were not the full set of instruments because one of the magnetic field instruments had failed back at Saturn. And so in order to really tell that they'd left this bubble of our sun, you needed not only the cosmic ray instruments like Ed's, but you needed the magnetic field measurements as well. And they didn't have them. And so when they popped out of the bubble and saw the cosmic rays change dramatically from the solar kind of particles to the interstellar kind of particles, a bunch of people jumped up and down and said, yay, we've left. But Ed was like, well, we really don't have the magnetic field data to tell us for sure. So he was very conservative and very cautious. Then a big solar flare happened that provided some additional information that made the case. Voyager 2 has all the working instruments. So Voyager 2 will pop out of the bubble sometime this year or next year, and it should be pretty unambiguous. All the instruments that are needed should say, hey, we're out. And then we'll have two spacecraft traveling in interstellar space.
Everything that we've talked about so far in relation to this mission and everything you talk about in the book makes me think of these two spacecraft on somewhat similar trajectories. Not anymore, but they were at one point. This is like, I don't know, how many? 8, 9, 10 different missions all being done by these spacecraft?
Right.
It's mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling, and it's really a manifestation of the fact that they are so well equipped in terms of their instrument suite to make measurements throughout the electromagnetic spectrum and imaging and squiggly lines and thermal measurements, et cetera, and also that they have encountered so many different kinds of objects, planets, moons, interstellar dust, rings, interplanetary dust, all these different areas of science which are all brought together in one ship of exploration.
Hmm. Just one more thing. I've got a couple of lines there from very near the end of the book. Would you read those for us?
Absolutely. We are all living, right now, in an amazing golden age of exploration of our planet and of our solar system. And if we look closely in our mind's eye, we can see the Voyagers quietly ushering us to and across the threshold of the interstellar age.
I think Carl would be proud.
Thanks.
Thank you, Jim. Great to have you back on the show.
Great to be on the show, Matt.
Planetary scientist Jim Bell's new book is The Interstellar Age, Inside the 40-Year Voyager Mission. It has just been published by Dutton. Time for What's Up once again on Planetary Radio. Here is Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. Welcome back. How are things?
Hunky-dory, spiffy, keen, swell. How about you, Matt?
It's kind of wet outside, but I'm in here where it's relatively warm. If there was a night sky, we don't really have much of one the last few days here, what would we see?
If there were not clouds, you would see still Venus and Mars low in the west shortly after sunset, although they are getting farther and farther apart, and Mars is gradually sinking lower and lower. So Venus about 100 times brighter, the really bright thing in the west in the early evening. Mars below it, much dimmer, looking reddish. But you can once again spin your head around and see Venus. No, you can see Jupiter. Well, if you spin your head all the way around, truly Linda Blair. But otherwise, spin it half the way around and see Jupiter looking bright in the east up in the early evening and Saturn coming up later in the evening. We move on to this week in space history. In 2004, 11 years ago, Rosetta was launched. And right now in the midst of its primary exciting mission, hanging out at a comet.
It's a shame it takes so long to get places in the solar system. They'll have to do something about that.
It really is. Why don't you work on that?
I'll get on it.
Speaking of getting places, 1979, Voyager 1 flew past Jupiter, giving us all sorts of cool imagery and data.
How appropriate for our conversation with Jim Bell today. And folks should stay tuned because that's going to come up during the trivia contest.
Folks should always stay tuned.
Well, you're right. You're right.
Moving on to Ron, dum, space fact. Yeah.
Just think if I'd remembered to get Jim Bell to say random space fact, we wouldn't have been treated to that this week.
Yeah, he probably would have said it exactly the same way. Ceres, in honor of Don getting captured by Ceres gravity, going into orbit later this week. We have some Ceres random space facts and trivia. Ceres was originally announced as a comet, then was known as a planet, then an asteroid, then a dwarf planet. Prior to Discovery, rumor has it Ceres was a tinker, tailor, soldier, and spy.
Well, little known fact there, which is what Random Space Fact is all about. All right, on to the contest.
All right, we asked you in what I'm guessing was a popular and disturbing topic, how many bathrooms or toilets are there on the International Space Station? How'd we do?
Oh, man. Biggest response in a long time. Don't know if it was the prize or the opportunity to provide us with space potty humor. But regardless, we did get this entry from Sheridan Gillam in Australia, who said that he believes, now, okay, here is why everyone in the world wishes they were Australian. He says there are two dunnies on the International Space Station. Yes, dunnies.
I have no idea if that's true or not, but there are two toilets.
Sheridan, good on you. He picked this up. And our prize this week, what he picked up is a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account worth $200 American, not Australian. Although iTelescope.net, I think, is more or less based in his home nation. And we're going to send him a Planetary Radio t-shirt. He added this, Bloody Rip a Podcast.
Is that a compliment?
I think it is, yes. I think the bloody is the strongest indication of that. For anybody who's curious out there, there is a YouTube video that actually has astronaut Suni Williams showing you one of the potties on the ISS, and in great detail. It's a TMI experience. So we'll thank listener John Harrison for that. We do have some other stuff here that I just have to mention. First, a straight one from Ilya Schwartz, our regular in Maryland. He says, indeed, there are two toilets, but a new one is being worked on, a next-generation space toilet called the Universal Waste Management System. It's universal.
Ohms.
From Kev Knowles in New Zealand, he couldn't resist this. It's an example of a place where astronauts boldly go where no one has gone before. And finally, this that I think you'll enjoy from Ron Rose. Common question on Google, apparently, is how many bathrooms are on the Death Star? This conjures images of Darth Vader taking care of business. So I really hope I win to soothe my mind from the mental image I have endured. Sorry, Ron. Better luck next time with this, and you'll have to live with
May
that image.
May the force be with you.
As will the rest of us. I'm done.
I'm done, too.
No. Tell us what
going
to do for next
week.
Going back
to something more conventional, thankfully. Who discovered Ceres and in what year? Go to planetary.org/radio contest. Get us your entry.
And we're going to give you this time until the 10th. That would be Tuesday, March 10th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer. And how's this for a prize? A copy of Jim Bell's brand new book, the one we just talked about, The Interstellar Age, inside the 40-year Voyager mission. But this one is signed by Jim Bell.
Cool.
Get those entries in.
All right, everybody. Go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about what you don't know about dunnies. Thank you. Good night.
Good on you, Bruce. He's the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. By the way, that video, that Too Much Information video, we'll put a link to it at on the show page this
How
week.
Nice
of course we will. It'll be at planetary.org/radio. He is the Director of Science and Technology who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its ever-voyaging members. Josh Doyle created our theme music. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. Live long and prosper, everyone.